Welcome to the Mike to New Haven podcast with sports personality Mike Colon. Here's your host, Mike Colon.
Saw a separate interview you did. You talked about your PTSD from that day and what helped you heal. And yes. Things that hurt you. You talked about Jeff. You talked about, obviously, 9/11. And I'm sure there were other jobs, too, that naturally, I mean, you know, Glenn Klein talked about it's kind of like a sponge. It absorbs and absorbs, and eventually you can't just wring all of it out all at once. It's not that easy. You even mentioned even after you retired, Sandy Hook, something like that hurt you, or the Boston Marathon. What has helped you to, you know, much like I asked Glenn, cope with that PTSD and just not just forget, it's not easy to forget, but learn to not let it dominate you and ruin you?
Mike, first, I want to applaud you. Thank you very much. I didn't know if it would have been appropriate to bring that up on your show, but I'm glad you did, because I'm sure there are a lot of guys silently suffering from that experience and maybe from some other experience prior to 9/11. And to answer your question, it was my family, my friends. I transitioned to Pennsylvania, and let me apologize. Is anybody watching that wondered what happened to Ronnie Griffith? I was all screwed up and I just tried to escape. All right. But I love all you guys and I love what you did for me. One of the greatest units in the world. Some of the greatest people I've ever met in my life. But to move on, I met a new slew of people that were willing to deal with my issues and help me get through them. You know, I took some counseling. I was with people that were also suffering like I was, and we did some peer counseling. I actually volunteered my time. I've been a track coach since I left ESU, a junior high school track coach, 18 years. As a matter of fact, this is my first year not coaching, and my team wins the Penn State. Figure that. 18 years, no Penn State champ as soon as I leave. Coach Sean is listening. Congratulations. But on a serious side, Mike, it's just permitting people to help you. And there were a lot of people willing to help me. And it's about opening up and being honest. For a long time, I was just trying to avoid it. I was angry. I was bottled up. And I would have these triggers and, you know, retreat. And I didn't want to deal with it or deal with anybody. I'll tell you, I even feel bad talking to your show. I moved away from emergency and I didn't keep a lot of close contact with emergency people because it was a trigger for me. A couple of years ago, Tony Sampietro and Jack Cambria got me. I came all the way down to the field. The ceremony started. I started crying uncontrollably. I couldn't stay. I didn't want anybody to see me like that. You know, I don't feel so strongly now, but, you know, I'll always feel like we left those guys behind. You know, I'll always wonder why them and not me, you know. And I understand that we all, you know, all 23 NYPD, we all went there and more, understanding what the sacrifice could be. But there is something to survivor's guilt. There really is. And especially when you have an intimate relationship, you know, you brought guys up, and I don't want to disrespect anybody. Clofer, Valentin, those guys trained me, you know. Those guys, I would go to 7 Truck, those guys would treat me like a little brother, you know, feed me, take care of me. And, you know, those guys aren't here anymore. And I mean, and I couldn't say bye, and I couldn't really be there to help them, Mike. And that's real. That's real, man. You know, Joey Vidge, like my brother, he was in my STS class, you know. Mm-hmm. Hardy guy, man. All those guys. Unbelievable. Yeah. So I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer, but I'm just trying to address your question.
It's, you know, and I'm glad that you're here. Don't leave it untold, my friend.
Okay. Oh, the other story is I used to, after this occurred, and it's a true story, I used to enjoy telling this story to other people in front of Ray Downey because he would get a kick out of it. And the story is it's the middle of the night. It's, I can't remember really what season it was, but there was a fire off of 13th Avenue in the 50s. It was a Queen Anne going there. And we get there, there's reports of people trapped and whatnot. And Jerry O'Donnell, a legendary lieutenant from Ladder 147, he comes like stumbling out of the front door as we pull up and everything. And so, you know, Captain Downey took charge. He's sending 2 guys up an aerial ladder. I think it was Pete Bondi and Bruce Howard. And I said to Cap, I said, I'm going to head right up to the attic. He goes like, go to the attic. So I was going up to the attic, and And there was an engine, and going up to the attic, the stairs, like there was maybe about five stairs going up one way and then five stairs going up the other way to the doorway to the attic. And there's a room on fire up there, and fire's like, you know, lapping out of the doorway. So an engine company had a 2.5-inch hose line stretched, but it was uncharged. So I sort of, you know, I was going past him to go up to make the search in the attic, and the officer put his arm across the banister. They said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I got to make a search up there." He goes, "Well, we don't have any water." I said, "I don't care." I said, "I got to make a search up there." So, well, like, he goes, "Well, you can't go." I said, so I pushed his arm out of the way, and he said to me, he goes, "Go, okay, go ahead, tough guy, see what you can do." So I get up to the top step. I get up my hands and knees, and the fire's in the back room. But like I said, it's lapping out across the ceiling and over the door. So I'm making a search of the front room, and it's the attic in this Queen Anne actually turned out to be a pretty big area. So I'm making my search. I could hear like the fire crackling, and, you know, I'm saying, "Well, is it over my head, or am I hearing it back by the door?" And kind of when you're doing that and you're alone and there's no water, you know, there's no water on the fire, you know, things can really get out of hand pretty quickly on you in a Queen Anne. So like I start crawling out, and as I'm crawling out, Captain Downey's coming up the stairs, and he turns to me and goes, "You got a primary on the top floor?" I said, "Well, I didn't get the whole thing yet." And he goes, get back in there, get back in there. And I was like, I turned around, I went back, and then like having him with me, it's a little different when you have someone else with you. And we made a search, and it turned out the search was negative. But like I said, when I would tell this story later on, I would always tell it in Downey's presence to other people. And I said, the moral of the story is almost like an Aesop's fable, is that I was more scared of Downey than the fire. You know, and he was like get a little smile out of him, like, from that.
Just a quick story with John Coughlin. We were in an EDP job, and I was the first person to make entry into that in the apartment. The guy had two knives, and as we went to make the grab, there was water on the floor. I had slipped, and he's coming down stabbing. I had a bunker, and he's stabbing the bunker, and everybody's like freaking out. And next thing I know, I see this Y bar come above me, and John Cog literally picked the guy up with this Y bar. Guy drops the knife, and then everybody starts tackling him. So I think if John did do that, he probably would have stabbed me at least once or twice. The bottom line is, for months, you know, my mom makes her own Italian sauce. For months, he kept asking me for Italian sauce, and I would forget. That next day, after that incident, I walked him with 4 jars of Italian sauce. And he's like, "You know, Franco, is this what it took for me to get 4 jars of sauce?" And it was comical, but it was, you know, I mean, I don't know how else to say thank you to him for that. You know, it was one of those moments between me and him, like, "Here, John, you know," but good man, good people.
Absolutely. So that brings us to 2003. It took a while for ESU to come to grips with not just John and Steve losing their lives, but all 14 of these guys that brought so much to the unit. You can't replace them. But ESU did a good job of soldiering on, and certainly an STS class came after that. And those guys, you know, they continued to do great work and respectfully honor the legacies of these fallen heroes. And in 2003, you went to Ray Kelly's detail. By that point, you've been on the job almost 20 years. You're having a great time in emergency service between transit and, of course, the NYPD. But certainly this is a unique opportunity for you. How did it come about? And even though I know it was a tough decision, probably, what made you say, "You know what, even though I love emergency, I think I'm going to do this"?
Well, I'm going to a short story. My sister had cancer. She was a Sloan Kettering. And at the time, Bill Bratton was the police commissioner. And I remember Bratton was walking into Sloan Kettering with his detail. And I was going in to see my sister, and I looked at his detail, and I'm saying, "Wow, how cool would that be? You know, that's got to be such a great job, being around the police commissioner." It was never an option for me when I was a transit cop. That was not even an option. You were never going to be the police commissioner's security detail. And here we are now, ESU, NYPD. Good friend of mine who was a captain. Somehow he got in contact with a guy, one of the sergeants on the detail, and they were talking. And they said, "Yeah, we're looking for people." My friend said, "You know what? Got a good guy, Franco Baraducci, in the issue. Why don't you give him the interview?" And they gave me the interview. And 2 days later, they said, "Franco, we want you." And, you know, Mike, I'll be honest with you, is I love the issue. But one thing about me, I was never scared to make change, good or bad. You know, you never know if the grass is greener on the other side. But I was like, "You know what? this is an opportunity that in my life I never thought I would have. And here I am. I have this opportunity to work for Ray Kelly. And I said, let's do it. And yeah, it broke my heart to leave ESU, but I was like, you know what? Sometimes when the opportunity knocks, you got to take advantage of it. And I did.
Right. What's Yogi Berra? What's his old saying? When there's a fork in the road, take it. Yeah. So there you go.
I can't even describe how proud I was to be a member of emergency service after in those, not just on September 11th, but the days after. I mean, what the unit was doing was nothing short of superhuman in just continuing to go and look for survivors, to collect remains, and then dignitaries started coming. So we had to do all kinds of dignitary protection on top of that. It was one of the most exhausting but rewarding times in my life. I never would want to do it again, but I'm very proud that I went through it when I did. You know, throughout the night, people would rotate in and dig. And John was buried when I got to him from his waist down, laying face down, just sticking like straight out, like something you'd see in a movie, like if a transporter put somebody back together, like sticking out of a wall. That's basically what he looked like because he was just crushed by so much concrete dust. So again, we would go in and they said, well, you're in ESU, do you want to stay in there and dig? And I'm like, I can't do both. Because I'll exhaust myself. I'm the only medic here. So right after I went in, a doctor showed up, John Chavonis, who had come from Pennsylvania just to see if he could help, and he turned out to be a surgeon. So it was pretty good. He was a paramedic before he was a physician, so he kind of knew what I was capable of, and level-headed guy. He was, I believe, a captain at the time in the Army, also reserves. So he was excellent. He had an excellent treatment plan. He had a lot of courage, let us say, because he also went into this space that was, you had to go down an I-beam, kind of like this, about 20-something feet underneath the tented portions of collapsed flooring, and then lay on your stomach and crawl in about 20, 25 feet. And you couldn't raise yourself up past, you know, a couple of inches. And then you were just face to face, and only one person could make contact with him at a time. So it was just unbelievable. It was simply unbelievable. In 2001, with all the rescue equipment that we had in the city of New York, between the fire department, the police department, and everybody else that was there, and we were digging this man out handful by handful with your hands. And maybe at one point, I gave them a pocket face mask. You know, it's like a plastic holder. And they broke it in half and were using those to scoop under them. So there was the big technology, New York City in 2001, how we were going to get somebody out of a building collapse.
I'll let Ray take it away in a second. That will listen to this on the audio version and won't watch it on YouTube. There, Kevin Shea is being lowered on that rope. And Kevin Shea, it doesn't matter what gear you're wearing. He could have had all the protective gear in the world. You fall from a height like that. At best, and I use that lightly, you're going to be seriously injured. At worst, you're going to die. So there's so much pressure there. You knew how to do it, but even then, it sends, as you said in that clip, shivers down your spine. Getting in there and not even having time to think, do you think that's what helped you in this rescue?
I don't know if that helped me in this rescue. when I got up there, one of the things that was interesting is that not everyone had a harness back then. For some reason, I was working the day they were giving them out, and I got one. Kevin had one, obviously, but not everyone had the harness. So I actually thought I was going to go over because I didn't know what had taken place and when I walked up there, that all went on before I got there. So when I asked Lieutenant Brown at the time, do you need any help? I actually thought I might be the one going over because I had the harness, but it turns out they wanted me to lower Kevin. So I basically jumped into that role. And I also knew that the rope was not connected. It wasn't tied off at the other end, which is part of the safety procedure, because it had been changed. It had been revamped because we had experienced a double fatality with two firefighters up in Harlem. And so they had redone the whole rope. It was treated like a very, it still is to this day, treated as sort of a very sacred piece of equipment. And each company has one. The engine has one and the ladder company has one. So Patty Brown was in charge of it. You can see, obviously, it takes more than two people to do this. And, you know, it was basically the highlight of my career without realizing it maybe that day. But, you know, I know I've had so many firefighters talk to me over the years about how that whole rescue inspired them and to be firefighters. And I fully understand that. You can hear the applause of the people in the street after the rescues were completed. And what a lot of people don't know is that was a recording studio that was on fire, and the smoke, you know, we kind of had like a wind driven fire there in a sense, because you'll notice that the smoke comes in and it goes out and it changes direction, and it was extremely toxic smoke. Climbing up the stairs a couple of levels down, you could smell it. It's just all rubber and plastic burning off the wires, and very nasty. And, you know, the rescue, we were assigned, I was in Ladder 24 that day, and we were assigned, I believe, as an extra ladder company or the second ladder company. I'm not 100% sure. And so, you know, we were there. It turns out I was there, and I ended up assisting them. It's usually just the opposite. Usually the rescue might be assisting, you know, the regular company. But, it was just an amazing event. You know, unfortunately, some of those firefighters aren't with us. Some of them were killed on 9/11. But that day is an iconic day for the FDNY, and it put us on the map, so to speak, because it showed, you know, bravery. There's plenty of, obviously, firefighters are brave all the time, but I think it just put on display our last-ditch effort to get someone, and that's what that rope is all about. It's like the last way to get someone, and we did it. We did it twice, and it was very successful.
Well, you know what? I want to make mention of this, because we were talking about this off the air. You mentioned working with the Bureau of Fire Investigations. Of course, that is the Fire Marshal's Office, for those that may not know. And a lot of the arsons, a lot of the, you know, the explosions, you guys are working jointly on that. And you and Louis Garcia, who will be on this show soon, are very good friends. And you two basically rewrote the manual on how to jointly investigate. Because back then, you know, the PD and the FD, now they relatively get along. But this was the era in which particularly you were seeing the rescue units and emergency service not get along. And basically, to avoid having a repeat of that in the Detective Bureau, with their, you know, Fire Investigations Bureau, you two teamed up and really consolidated things in a way that, you know, has still to this day made those investigations a lot easier. So tell me about that without getting into the classified stuff, of course.
The last time there was a MOU was under Benjamin Ward, I believe, and it was getting old. It was getting a lot of problems in the field. Take, for instance, the Happy Land Social Club, right? 87 people were killed in the social club that night. Luckily, within 12 hours, Julio Gonzalez was arrested for the fire, but it worked out great. You have to have all the information going into one bucket. You know, BFI can't be doing their thing, ATF doing theirs. The local detective squad, who actually had lead in the case. And there'd be four different entities, if not maybe even feds coming in, other feds coming in. So you can't have that. All the information has to go into one bucket. And then from that information, you got to figure out what steps you want to take next. Do you want to interview this person? or would interviewing him maybe give something up? Do you want to hit a search warrant or not? You have to have strategies that are going to work. So to make sure this worked, Louis and I was from PD, Louis from FD, to try to get something, a working agreement with both jobs. Because the fire marshal, Bureau of Fire Investigation, they're professionals, you know, and they're chartered by the city charter, that they're the only ones that are allowed to do a cause and origin out of fire. We, in turn, you know, A&E, we'll want to maybe a little bit later, we got our guys to be, we feel, parallel as far as being able to determine a cause and origin, even though by the city charter, we're not allowed to do it on paper for the city. So we can question, we could talk with the BFI guys and say, well, what about this and what about that? So this MOU was so that when you get on the scene, like I said, BFI professional people, there's an important case, you know, come down, they want to have that case, but for some reason, A&E is going to come in and grab it from them. So there had to be a reason for it. And that's what that MOU brought out. You have to figure BFI guys, they started as fire investigators, I mean, as firemen, then they became investigators and they get trained. And maybe they're on in that position for a year or so, where some of the A&E guys or ATF guys have been doing it for 8-10 years. And they have a lot of other backup units to help them out, support systems. So what this did, it kind of lined out, okay, BFI, you get these cases. Arson explosion, you get the other ones. So when something did happen, you didn't have to go there and argue about it. Whoever the fire department supervisor was would know, okay, that's not ours or it is ours. And if we got there and we saw that fell on the Bureau of Fire Investigation, we would just help them out and they would get the case. And hopefully it wouldn't be, it could get very argumentative out in the field, you know, and also it could lead to a bad case because you're both going in different directions and all the evidence isn't coming into one bucket.
It was amazing. I was actually still in PMD and they actually wanted me to go ticket scalp and like to lock those guys up. Like nobody can go home. I'm like, no, I'm going to the game. I got game 7 tickets. I'm going. And it was the greatest feeling. Like you're right. The tension that was in there. And also, it seems like the last 2 minutes last 20 minutes. Like, when is this game going to end? And I don't know if McTavish might have taken the last, one of the last face-offs.
He took the last face-off.
Lomer in the corner, like it was already past zero and he was still playing. Like he didn't, you know, it took a split second for him to realize that the game is over, you know. I'll never forget that. And everybody just going nuts and crazy. And then finally when Messier picked up that cup, it was like, you know, it was the greatest feeling. Like the sign said, I can die in peace.
Yep. You know, it was funny about that game. Is that, to your point, they had called a really nonsensical icing call because Pavel Bure, he just gave up on the puck and he was trying to get an icing call. Right. And Terry Frazier gave it to him. So Messier pulled McTavish over. Mind you, these guys had won cups together in Edmonton. Like I said, he said, it's 1.6 on the clock. They're not going to call a penalty here. Cross check them. So it was Bure against McTavish. Mac kind of hooked them a little bit and then Messier cross checked them. But as you said, they're not going to call a penalty at that stage. So they ended up, you know, the clock hit zero and they won the cup. But you were also, I think you were at the conference finals game 7 with New Jersey as well. Now that was even – the cup final game 7 is one thing. That was pretty tension-filled. But this was too because Messier has the guarantee in game 6. He delivers on the hat trick. Here they are in game 7. They were seconds away, but I think it was Stefan Richer that tied the game with like 10 seconds left. And then there's these two overtimes that are heart-stopping. And Mateau comes down. And after the Devils get a really good chance to score on the other end, Richter stops him. Mateau scores. So being in that in the building for that game, really in one of the greatest playoff series of all time in hockey history, at least. Tell me about that one.
Well, that was another, like I said, it was a real nail-biter. And then when they tied the game up, Everybody, the whole place died. Like the whole, I never heard the guard. It was like it was awake. It was quiet. And I never forget, like in between the next, when they were going to overtime, like, you know, crowd started getting a little bit louder, but I went to the bathroom. And as I was in the bathroom, everybody's like, we're going to win. You know, people start yelling. And then as we were walking back out into the, arena, it was like a crescendo of like the whole garden started going crazy. And it was like, just then, I was like, we're gonna win this game. There's no way we're losing it. You know, it was just like, it was back on again. And then when they won, it was, yeah, that was the greatest game I ever been at, that one, you know. I mean, it was great for game seven, but I had game seven against Vancouver unless we won that one, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen,
you know, that game.
No, and Jersey had a great team back then. I mean, that was the precursor to them winning their cups. Obviously, they had a bunch of Hall of Famers. I mean, Scott Stevens, one of the greatest hitters of all time. Scott Niedermeyer, Marty Brodeur, Claude Lemieux was on that team. He ended up helping Colorado win a cup in '96. A couple years later, so you know that was a great team in its own right. And I think you were telling me. So this is funny. So they're having the parade, right? And these guys, listen, they'd had some fun the night before. And Brian Leetch told this story one time when he was getting interviewed by Michael Kay, the Yankee broadcaster. And Michael had asked him, have you ever dropped the Stanley Cup? And Brian said, no, but I've seen it dropped. And you were there when I think Adam Graves, who might have been gravied up, shall we say, pardon the pun, dropped the Stanley Cup.
Well, they were out. I was assigned to the beginning, you know, the parade that day. And I was signing, you know, where the formation was, and they were coming off the ball, and they're coming the stairs. I don't really remember who, because I really didn't see that, because my sergeant Peasley was in the, you know, was in front of me. But they were coming down the steps, and somebody like dropped the cup, you know, fell down. It just hit the, it didn't fall to the side, it fell straight down, so it wasn't cracked or anything like those Colorado, but it fell straight down. I could have sworn, you know, that I saw like Gravy, you know, and Leach getting off the bus. But I mean, they were all, I forgot who was, but they were on that bus anyway. Who actually had it in his hands? Like I said, I didn't see it, but I slipped down. And then my sergeant was right there, and he, you know, he was a diehard Islander fan, but he was a Rams fan. And he goes, Kevin, I think you should do this. And he pushed me towards the stairs, and I got to pick it up and give it back to Gravy, and Leach were both there. I don't know who grabbed it, but it was like the Gravy, you know, I finally got to feel the cup, you know, especially in that year, you know. So I don't know who actually, I couldn't swear, I couldn't go in front of a judge and jury and tell you who dropped it, but somebody did.
So 1994, I was the bar commander in the Bronx, and we became aware that there was going to be this concert in upstate New York, and I liked good music, and I liked the environment and the atmosphere. And so I tried to involve myself in the operation. And by what I mean by that is I communicated with the folks that were planning the event, Woodstock. And I said, listen, I have some vacation time. I can take leave from the city. I'm a paramedic. I'm a chief officer, special operations background. I have a lot of experience planning for and managing these events. I'd like to offer my services to you, right? And essentially I was rebuffed. And they said, you know, thanks very much. If you want to work as a line paramedic, you know, we'll be happy to have you as a volunteer paramedic in the mud. That's fine. But we don't need any leadership or anything like that. So, you know, thanks very much, but no thank you. So I said, all right, guess that's not going to happen. You know, I'll watch the movie afterwards, right? A couple of weeks before Woodstock, I had contact with a gentleman who worked for the State Department of Health, who said, you know, we're going to need some help monitoring our health department permit. The State Health Department in New York issues a permit when you have a mass gathering over 5,000 people that stipulates that you're meeting the medical need requirements for the people that are there. So they said, we're going to look for some help to monitor that permit. Would you be interested in coming to help us? And I said, sure, happy to do that. Because if it would get me to the music, I would be happy. I don't have to work or get my hands dirty. Just keep an eye on things. No problem. So I went up there a couple of days before the concert started. I'm on vacation. I relaxed from the city work, and I check in up at Woodstock. I'm going to be staying in a trailer there. And they introduced me to the Hired Guns, a private company that was hired to manage EMS for Woodstock. So I got to spend about 12 hours riding around with the leaders of that organization. And that night we had a meeting, myself and Ray Flora, a colleague of mine, paramedic school colleague, who is running the ambulance service at the time, Rockland Paramedics. I just recently retired. And they were the contract ambulance service and the state health department. And the state health department official said, so what do you think? And I said, you're going to have a real problem. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, these folks really have no idea what they're in for. They have no organization. Their entire workforce is volunteer. They don't have communication set up. They don't have any idea about incident management. And this is going to collapse as soon as something happens here. And they said to Ray Florida, what do you suggest we do? And Ray said, I think you should put Zach in charge. So they asked me if I would do that. And I made one of probably the hallmark mistakes of my career, because I didn't say, sure, here's a contract, just pay me this much and I'll be happy to do that. But instead I just said, sure. So with no pay and no charge, I said, I need you to give me all the resources that they have, put that at my disposal, and I'll organize it. So what then became our process over the next 18 hours was we brought everybody together who had any kind of supervisory background, read through resumes, built a communication center, organized teams and divisions and groups, implemented incident command, gave people assignments, and created an EMS system for Woodstock. And so we went through a number of challenges in 1994. We had rain, we had mud. It was very much like the first Woodstock. We had Port of Sands surfing when they were sliding the Port of Sands down the hills. We had literally 3 days of caked up mud and no bathrooms. And it was a very interesting environment. And we ran our EMS operation through that with a workforce of about 400 volunteers, which whittled down to about 150 by the time we were done. And I should say it trended down to about 150, but we got the job done. We had 5,500 patients in 5 days there. And, you know, for that week, it was the third largest city in New York State. It was just Woodstock. And fortunately, I think we had very, very little loss of life. We were successful. We had a medevac operation. And it was absolutely an extraordinary experience. And our team, everybody did well. And we left there feeling very proud of what we did. Woodstock 94.
So I started when I could to do some anchoring. Good Morning America, if you watch that program, the Today Show does the same. At 25 minutes after the hour, they cut out and go to local news.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, while local news was going on, ABC and Good Morning America actually had somebody doing a newscast for stations that weren't doing local news at that hour, at 25 minutes after. I don't know who was carrying it, probably some station in Ottumwa, Iowa or something. I know, but I went in and I did that. And then I'd go off to the house. I did those little 5-minute newscasts, probably for nobody. Nobody was watching, but I did them. And Joan London took notice of it. And when David Hartman retired, Joan said, this guy Gibson has a nice way about him. I don't know what it was she saw, but forever grateful to her for it. So I was one of the people who tried out for Good Morning America. And because I was going to get stuck in the reporting hierarchy behind Sam and behind Britt, I thought, yeah, if you're willing to consider me for the GMA job, yeah, great. Phil Buth was the executive in charge of Good Morning America. And he said to me, you're on the list. You're one of the people we're considering. If you lose interest in us, give me a call. And if I lose interest in you, I'll call you. Well, neither one of those phone calls ever took place. And I tried out for a couple of weeks here and there, and eventually got the job. It was not something that I had ever thought about, aspired to, but it came into my lap. Phil Buth is one of those people who came into my life and totally changed the direction of it. And I'd never met the guy before. He's a wonderful old crusty guy. He's in his 90s now, lives down in Florida. Still in touch with him on occasion. He changed my life. And I went up to New York, succeeded David Hartman. And for 19 years, I had the privilege, and I really considered it a privilege and an honor, 4 times a day, every half hour, to say, Good Morning America. I think it's the best named program in the history of television. And we got to be at P people's breakfast tables. And as a result, I always say as a result of that show, because it's a very personal connection that you work out with viewers, much more so than other. It's a very personal time of day. I always say the beds aren't made, the dishes aren't done, the kids are running around like banshees, and here I am, this chirpy twerp sitting on a couch with a tie on saying, let me into your house at this very personal time of day. So people looked at you personally and looked at you not in just as a reporter, but as a friend. I always used to say I have millions and millions of friends that I don't know. But doing that program was really wonderful experience. I'll never have anything like it. The hours are terrible, obviously, but I would get up at 3:20 every morning, and that was hell. But anyway, other than that, it was a great program to do, and I loved it. And I had a chance to do it. I really did two different programs because it was a different show with Joan, which I did for 11 years, and then 8 more years with Diane. And they had a different approach. I just was there basically to get them both coffee.
Yeah, pick up the phone. It's sometime maybe 1:15 in the morning. And I was a female detective. And she's telling me that they have a person in the squad room that came from a residence and was explaining in broken English that there's some students that were in the room and that sharing an apartment, and they had been constructing devices, and he left and he wanted to call. Well, he wanted to advise. He found police officers in the street. I think they were transit police officers. And to advise them that, you know, before these guys wake up, this is what they're doing. And then, you know, the rest is history. They brought him into the squad room.
Joe was given the key to get into place. And Joe puts the key in the door. And go ahead, Dave. Tell him what happened.
Go ahead. He turns the key and he looks at me like a big puppy that he is. He looks at me and goes, Dave, I think I locked the door. So I look at him and I said, well, open the effing door and let's go. And it was, you know, despite all that tension, despite all of what we're going through, it was a moment of laughter almost, you know, like of all things, to lock the door.
And safety first.
Yeah. The whole problem with the open door was, I kind of put myself in these guys' position that if I'm making bombs to use tomorrow, why am I leaving my door unlocked? So that kind of, while we were all chuckling about me locking the door when we're trying not to tip them off that we're coming in, and, you know, I figured that maybe we weren't going to get past that door to begin with. So, but at that point, Dave summed it up the best, you know. We've unzipped our fly. They know we're coming, you know, so let's go. So you got to go at that point. You can't stop now. So I shoved the door open and nothing happened. So we ended up making the entry, and it was laid out exactly the way the guy explained it. So go ahead, Dave. You can go on with this.
Yeah, Joey opens the door. We go in. I see the two individuals at the other end of the room sleeping on a cot. And the one gets up, he starts to, Abu Meza came charging towards me. I shot him. And then Lafi Khalil gets up. And we're stepping on the bomb satchels themselves. We didn't even realize it. But he lunges towards me. I hit him midair on his lunge. He dropped like a rock. And then Joey looks down and he's like, holy cow, we're standing on the bombs, you know. So at that point, we cleared them out. We dragged them out all the way to the front, dropped them on the floor, went back in, and continued clearing the building out.
Actually swung out. So he had to be semi-nimble to get that door open, holding a gun and a bunker to pull the door towards him. And when he did, I had Sergeant English behind me. And you know, Dave isn't a little guy, and so he pretty much with his vest on took up the whole doorway. So I was standing behind him, and I heard the shots. You know, so I knew something was going on, but I really couldn't see. I guess as one of them started to move, Dave had to move to the left, and as he did, I shoved past him, and got into the room with Dave. And at that point, I saw the two individuals that Dave was dealing with, and the guy on the right. I ordered him, don't move, you know, don't move. And he looked at me, and then he looked down at the ground, and then I looked down at the ground where he was looking, and that's where very dim light. There was no real light in there. The only light that was in the room was the light of Dave's Glock, and just a little bit of sunlight coming through this window that had a covering on it. So it was a very dim lit room, but I could see a bag on the floor, and I looked at him, and he looked me straight in the face, and lunged. And as soon as he started to move, I shot him twice. And at that point, he stopped his movement. Mini 14s have a habit of doing that to you.
And you know, the two men that you mentioned, Jerry Sheen and John Santos, they taught me an awful lot. And I looked around; they weren't there that morning. So now it was up to me to actually start saying, "Oh crap! I gotta like actually do this stuff without them stopping any mistakes." Because an investigation like this, I knew was going to wind up in the hands of the Joint Terrorist Task Force, but they bring arson and explosion in just in case it isn't. If they some way or somehow is deemed not a terrorist thing, then it's going to fall under the purview of an arson and explosion investigation. And also, I figured they called us for a fall guy in case things really went bad. Blame A&E. So I get the phone call. I tell guys to respond different places. I had very few detectives. It was the summertime. We're a small squad. So I had guys on vacation. So I had a couple of guys go to the scene. I had one detective respond with me over to Kings County. And I arrived at Kings County, and one of the perps was already in the operating suite, and the other one was in the ER, in the emergency room, and they were prepping him to go into an operating suite. With him, guarding him, was a night watch detective, and one of the things that the detective brought to my attention immediately was the fact that they were very interested in what time it was. And they kept on asking about 9 o'clock. And, you know, now I needed to find out what this guy knew about 9 o'clock. So I wanted to question him a little bit. And there must have been this young, she was a young female resident doctor that was working there. And she took exception to the fact that I wanted to question this man. And, you know, I told her, I know I need to question him. I need to find out things that he knows and hopefully, you know, prevent a tragedy. And she goes, well, I'm not interested in your job. My job is to save his life. And I told her, well, my job is to save his life too. And then hopefully it saves other people's lives. Then I don't care what you do to him. But right now I'm going to talk to him. Well, in that same area of the emergency room was an old time nurse. And she was standing there. She watched what was going on and knew that, well, this young doctor needed to get out of the way. So she went over there and told this young doctor that she was needed elsewhere. And she left. And then the next thing I see is an anesthesiologist or his assistant come walking over, and he says, in 5 minutes, you could ask him anything you want. So I found out that they just got to, you know, came in from, they were Palestinian. They were part of Hamas. The 9 o'clock thing, I can never, you know, get a handle on what the 9 o'clock thing was. other than there may have been another group. That was the only thing I could, you know, kind of correlate together, because maybe there was another group that was going to go out, you know, in conjunction with them. Because a lot of times with these cells, they work independently, or sometimes they can team up. So we had to be a little aware of that. I got the information back to the scene as quickly as possible, to hope that that the guys, Paul Ritchie, for rendering safe purposes. I didn't know if the device was still at the scene or not, but you know, we certainly didn't want to be standing there at 9 o'clock finding out that there was another device that was going to detonate something.
I'll tell the funnier version. Anyway, I heard shots. I asked Paul, is that shots? He goes, I think so. And then we heard some more. And then we knew. But we had stripped down already because it was a very, very, very hot night. And we were going to wear our bomb suits. So all the clothes came off and we put on our it's a coverall, you know.
Nomex suits.
Yeah, a Nomex suit. So we're wearing that. And I took my gun off. I put it in a bag. He took his gun off. We went on an entry team. We trust emergency. They're going to take care of whatever. It's got to be shot now. So anyway, we heard the shots and we decided we're going to go in. Mario, he came out the door. He wasn't over the radio. He came out the door. He says, bomb squad, get in here. And I dove into my bag looking for my gun. And this is in the dark now. I grabbed the gun. I'm banging heads with Paul. He's trying to get his gun. But I got mine and I took off. Paul, like a good partner, always, he just forgot his gun and ran with me.
You know? I couldn't find it.
So I'm running through the building now and around the staircase and out the back door. And one of the guys, it was Meza. I believe it was Meza. He came through the door as I'm going through it. This was the door out the front building into the courtyard. And I actually I was running so fast, we met face to face. I actually had to jump over him and I wound up in the courtyard. We went in and we looked at the bomb and we told everybody, that's it, we're out of here. You know, I saw there was four toggle switches and one was thrown and the other three were still in the off position. So I figured, well, we went outside, we talked over it, and we talked about it, and we decided to let it cook for an hour. This way, if it heats up and it blows up, you give it an hour to do whatever it's going to do, you know. So an hour later, we went in. I took a little Polaroid camera with me. I took pictures of the whole scene, of the devices, of the room, where everything was.
And, Five.
Yeah, I took five.
Five pictures.
And I went back outside. We went back outside, and we spoke to our lieutenant, and I gave him the pictures. I go, this is what it looks now. I said, I can't promise what's going to look.
And then we had three left.
So anyway,
two disappeared.
We went back in and we looked at it. We started taking it apart. And I turned to Paul. I said, Paul, do me a favor. Get out of here. I don't want you in here with me. You know, I said, I promise your mother, we've been partners. We've been partners for 20 years on and off. I said, I promise your mother I would always have you survive this thing, you know. He said, but he wouldn't do it like the faithful partner he always was, you know. So he stayed in with me, which thank God he did, because I was looking at the one package, and then I wanted to get, the room was very small and everything was in our way, and we were wearing these big suits. So I started to clear around the package, and there was a TV set there. I took the TV set off. It was on top of a very fancy milk crate, you know, sort of furniture. And I went to move the milk crate, and he taps me on the helmet, and I see his hand with no, because you don't really talk to each other because you have fans going on. So, and I looked, and there was a filament line that ran off into another bag, and it was a booby trap. So I said, oh, man. So I said, okay. So I put the thing back. And we decided we're going to leave and go talk about this again. You know, so we left. We come back in. And I told the lieutenant, I said, listen, we got a booby trap in there. It's blocking our way. He tells me, he says, well, I want you to take care of that first package first. I go, no, I'm not doing that because it's in my way. This other thing is in my way. So then he thought about it. And he goes, oh, okay. I said, well, thanks a lot. You know, I'm doing the show, you know. So anyway, we went back in and opened up the flap. We saw everything. And we figured we're going to go with the ropes and tie it off and drag it out into the courtyard where we have a better look at it, you know. And we can use the robot also. So it went from ropes to robots. We used all kinds of modern and old technology on this stuff. There was a staircase that came down, and I put the rope through the staircase, and I pulled the package out. It got caught up, right, Paul? It got caught up when I had to go back in. I picked up the bomb and moved it around.
Yeah, we used the traffic cone. We used the traffic cone to get around the corners. It got stuck.
Yeah. So anyway, we got it out. And I roped it so that it went upside down and dumped everything right out, so I didn't have to go through the bag. It was all wires and four big batteries, the big square batteries, and 6-volt batteries, and 4 pipe bombs. Well, the other one too, we had to take care of that. There was a pipe bomb in there, and that had match heads in it. So, but anyway, we rented that safe, and we went on to the other one. So, and we used your robot on that. The thing that saved us is, after it was all over and all said and done, I took it apart and minus the explosives, and I put everything back together, all the switches. And I put electric matches in where the bombs were connected to the bombs. I threw the switches, and they all went off. So I said, this guy just failed electricity 101.
You know, it's a Polaroid picture. You know, how good could it be? But we were able to see that filament line in those pictures to look for it when we went in there to render it safe, to remove it. So I guess it was a learning experience for everybody. In and out of the house.
And again, we stood on the shoulder of guys from my father's generation. Then we had guys standing on our shoulder. It's those traditions and that dedication and wanting to do the job that makes it work. But I can bet you today, the ESU cops and the ESU bosses that are on patrol, many of them don't know me. I'm from a generation ago. Remember, I'm retired 19 years. Yeah. Many of these guys don't know me on a personal basis. But I can tell you right now, I can guarantee you, I know what their traditions are. I know that they're going to know the importance of never saying no to another cop, always helping another cop. I know the workload hasn't changed. You're still getting the gain entries, the lock-ins, the lockouts, on top of the hostage and the barricade jobs, the rescue jobs, the pin jobs, the jumper jobs. So, I mean, the unit keeps going forward, and I look at pictures that get posted online sometimes, and I'm like, wow, that's an awesome piece of equipment. We could have really used that back in the day. But, you know, that's the beautiful part about a small unit, a highly motivated group of individuals, male and female, who love being cops, who love doing the job, and want to be there to help other cops out. And I got to tell you, you know, these are tough times. These are tough times to be a cop now. Policing is not easy. Policing is difficult. But I remember when I first came on, cops, when I got to the 6-7, saying, why'd your father let you take this job? This job's dead. It sucks. There's no sense being a cop. Well, I still wanted to be a cop. Just like today, there's still guys that want to be police. They want to be cops. And you know what? My generation had to adjust to the changes from the early 60s. We had to start doing things a certain way. And the generation that's there today, they're trained to use cameras. They have better training, better equipment. They have better, less than lethal equipment. So you know what? If they want to be the police, tune out all the white noise, all the nonsense going on around you. It's still a noble job. It's still a great career. And I know right now, probably the chat room is lighting up with people saying, this guy's psychotic that he's saying that. You know what? This too shall pass. We have good times and we have bad times in policing. Every 25 years, it gets bad. There's a corruption scandal or it gets bad. Well, guess what? This will pass. The NYPD will bounce back. I have the utmost faith in the training and the traditions that the NYPD's instilled will. So, you know, when I hear things say, the unit stinks, it's not the way it was when you were there. No, maybe it's not the way it was when I was there. It's better than when I was there. You know why? It's got to be better because you got smarter people, better trained people with better equipment. So when a guy tells me, it's not the same when you were there, no, it's probably better than when I was there because we had better equipment than my father's generation, and this generation has much better equipment and much better training than my generation. So I don't want to hear, you know, I get off my soapbox there, maybe let you get a word in.
Nah, that was great. I'm fired up. Now I want to go take the test.
I like I actually, in if people listen to the show, they know I sort of have ups and downs with the show, like I do on my own mental health. I'm enjoying the show right now because I feel like it's just a good, there's a good chemistry in the room right now where we can talk about anything and nobody is sensitive to anything. We can just talk. We can have fun. We've created our own world where we can spend our whole day within that world. Or if we want to go out and do stories in the actual world, we can do that. To me, and I wouldn't want to do this, of course, but to me, the way the show is right now with Dave producing, Justin, Mike, and myself, you could, with me as the sort of the guy in the show and the three of them, we could plug this show into an FM station and it would be like a monster morning show. This is what it feels like. Obviously, the language would be different. Some of the content would be different. Mm-hmm. Not really. Like, I mean, I could do a show without swearing. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, I like the freedom of being able to say what I want. But it feels to me like a morning radio show that is in the pod, that has figured out how to do podcasts and has created its own world in that way now, which is, I'm enjoying. It's probably the most fun I've had because the stress is down. There are forces within trying to take the show down and they've been quiet. I think I'm sure they'll be back. But I've also kind of got the point in my life where I'm like, they're going to be here. They're not going to be here. And I loved Steve Robinson, my old producer. Dave brings a different perspective. Mike here, who's on the show, is having a lot of fun. Yeah. And Justin is, you know, a character as well. And the Minna fans, which is we call it, if you don't know the listeners of the show, are their own characters as well. We just did a couple of shows at the Wilbur that were great. We've been traveling around. We'll do some more shows. We just proposed something today. And I like the idea that kind of is this never ending thing. I am having fun with the show right now, for sure.
The one thing I'd like to say before we, I think,
sure.
About 4 years ago, maybe five, no more than five. You know, I realized that guys are getting really sick from exposure to 9/11, you know, and what happened was I reached out to Gene Kelly, was running the stuff through at the time. I can't remember exactly. I know she worked at a hospital that was dealing with a lot of, you know, guys that were coming down with the cancers. And I went with my wife. I had to actually go with my wife because the PTS kicked right back in me having to talk about this stuff. But I sat down with Jean and my wife. I talked to her on the phone. I think she told me to bring my wife. I think she could hear it just talking to me at the time. And, you know, she talked me into getting tested, you know, getting the 9/11, whatever the heck it's called now. I can't think now. But registered with them and getting tested. You know, I do have sleep apnea really bad. They put me, they sent me for testing for that. Put me, you know, gave me the CPAP and supplied me with that. And also the acid reflux is real bad. My understanding, not knowing at the time, but, you know, Gene had said that the spike in acid reflux, which leads to esophageal cancer and other things, it's pretty high. And, you know, I went down for initial testing, x-ray, I guess, of my lungs. And what they found out that I had was an aneurysm on my heart. You know, 9/11 doctor says, well, your heart, your lungs are good. You got one spot, you know, and, you know, it's so big and, you know, it's not that big. But you do have an aneurysm on your heart. You better seek medical attention for that. You know, of course, I go to my doctor. He sends me to a heart specialist, and he sent me to a thoracic surgeon, tell me, you know, what I have to do to avoid this aneurysm getting any bigger. But I wouldn't have known this. But other guys too, the same thing. You know, make sure you get out there. You know, people that were down there exposed to that stuff, including civilians. Plenty of civilians coming down with these crazy cancers, the spikes are high. You know, I talked to people about it and they said, well, how do they know what came from there? It's because the spikes in the New York area are tremendous, you know, as opposed to California and Colorado and all these other places that, you know, people that came down there for just an hour. You know, I was exposed to those fumes, and luckily I had a mask on. I had a mask in my jump bag that I put on, a decent mask, but that got clogged, but I still took some stuff in there. But again, go out and get tested. You know, a couple hours out of your life, a day or two, whatever it takes, get registered. My understanding, there will be only so much time that you can get, you know, get tested.
It's difficult sometimes to put this in perspective. It's one thing to verbalize it. It's another thing to write it down, because there's so many stories from that day. What prompted you to write that book?
After 20 years, I had a lot of time to reflect on what took place, and everything I did that day is either on video or audio tape. So I don't have any secrets. It's all there in public. But I wanted to walk people through what it was like that day, what it was like for me and my firefighters, and the days after. And I picked the title Ordinary Heroes because after 9/11, people asked me, how do you define a hero? And my definition of a hero is one who does ordinary things, but at an extraordinary time. And that's what we saw on 9/11. And that's what we see every day as our first responders run into danger. And we're not superheroes. We don't leap buildings in a single bound, but we'll run into danger so others may live. And that's why I entitled it Ordinary Heroes, and take people through the story of walking in my shoes, in my firefighter shoes, that day, the days and the months and the years after, and what that feels like, and what it means to lead, that the heart of crisis leadership is the ability to sustain hope by unifying effort to solve complex problems in the face of great tragedy. And that's what we did then, and that's what we do today, whether we're looking at mass violence in the United States and other parts of the world, or we're looking at the effects of climate change and dealing with wildfires and hurricanes, or many other disasters. It's only by unifying our efforts can we make a difference. And it is our ordinary heroes that will make that difference today as well as they did yesterday.
All right. And you kind of talked about it here, but if there's other ones, you could name them. Funniest call you ever responded to.
I meant to send you a picture and I didn't.
It's not too late.
Labor Day of 2004, maybe 2005. Doing a 4-12, just come in, cup of coffee. Equipment's on the Adam car. I'm working with Greg Welch. Jumper on the Brooklyn Bridge. Confirmed by division almost immediately. He's on the Manhattan Brooklyn Tower. It's okay. Start heading down. It was Labor Day. It was the Monday, and we get on the FDR Drive. As soon, you know, it was a flip of the coin. You know, if you didn't see cars from the elevated part, you know, when you got on the FDR, you gambled. Or if, when you went around the bend, past the power plant at 15th Street, and all of a sudden you get brake lights. You know, you knew you were committed now, at least down to Houston Street. We wide open. We made it all the way down to just before the bridge, and we hit traffic. Now everybody's stopping because they had bridge orders, the 5th Precinct on our side, the 8-4 on the other side. Depending on whether or not the cop was using common sense and knew that ESU was coming up the roadway, trying to talk to him on radio, you know, tell him to pull traffic. 8 truck had come the other way, counterflow, and they're on the bridge already. They're at the actual, you know, at the base of the tower, the Brooklyn Tower. They reconfirmed the job. Now we're just bottled up. We're pickled. We make our way around the bend. We ended up in an area where we could leave the REP. And Greg makes a comment. He says, I guess we're going to have to walk. I look at him. And I'm like, That's a far walk. Get out of the truck, open the bin, grab our personal rope bags, grab the 200-foot rope bag. And with that now, here comes two motorcyclists, like a ninja-type bikes with two guys got dreadlocks down to their rear ends. One guy's got a big spike on his helmet, and they're racing the engines, trying to zigzag through. So I see him. I'm like, you believe the nerve of these guys trying to get through like that? Greg goes, stop them. I'm like, yeah, you bet your bottom dollar I'm going to stop them. So I grab the one guy. Greg goes, get on. I'm like, what? And then it hits me. He's getting on the back of the one motorcycle. I get on the other. And it was like we were going on a double date. I'm holding on to this guy. He's on the other motorcycle. We got all the equipment. And we're telling this guy, you know, get up to the bridge, zigzag through the traffic, come out onto the bridge. We drive right past the 5th Precinct car. He's standing outside the car. He sees us going past. Give him a wave. We pull up. Adam 8, Truck 8, Boy 8, they're all there. They're actually making their way up, you know, onto the cables. And they see us, and they just start laughing. We get off the bike. Thanks, guys. And the guys race off. You know, now they got nobody. They just race back into Brooklyn, wherever they were going. Very funny. Too many funny ones. I don't want to. I could have you here till 8 o'clock. The funny jobs, the funny stuff.
Well, Mike and I and the team had some of it. It was awful. I'm not going to compare it to anything else. You know, because you can't. These things don't compare. It's one of those things where you think you may have seen it all. Until that happens, and that's what happened in emergency all the time. You know, you just see something that you never thought you would see. Oklahoma was a tough one because so first of all, for me, I was playing basketball, got home around 10-11 at night from the gym, and the phone rang about 1 a.m. It was Mike Corr, and he said, get your toothbrush and a few things. You don't need anything. We're going to Oklahoma. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. The bombing was at 9:08 or something like that. And, guys at the basketball game were asking me, you know, you think you'll go there? I played with a lot of cops and firemen from my neighborhood. We were all tight. I said, I don't know. I haven't heard anything yet. Probably not, I guess. But sure enough, there we were at Kennedy waiting to go. So, you know, then we get there and we were sent there because there was a team from California that didn't get along with the Oklahoma City firemen. Now, these guys lost some guys. And, you know, that was, you know, this is their, it's their house. And, you know, they didn't, they kind of tried to take over. And they requested that they be removed from the site. And FEMA did. And we got into the rotation. That's how we got there. That's what I was told. I'm pretty sure that's the story. You know, what you see walking up to it, you know, I was there. I was at the trade center in 93. And, of course, you know, it wasn't the devastation that we had, but, you know, still the terrorist act, but you couldn't see, it was on the ground. It wasn't as, you know, obviously as extreme. So seeing the building for the first time was, you know, just, you know, you've never seen it, you know, whatever, you've seen all the pictures. And then, you know, we get to work, and I was on a team that worked from 7 at night till 7 in the morning. And, you know, little things happen while you're going along, little things that you don't really kind of think of until later on. We slept on cots in a Marriott Convention Center, I think it was called, kind of like our Javits Center. And the kids from the high school, the students from the, we called them Bapticostal because everybody was Baptist or Pentecostal, you know, worshipers in Oklahoma. And they call themselves that, so, you know, because you never could know who you're talking to. But these kids, every night when I went to, every night when I went to work and came back, my bed was made and there was chocolate on my pillow every night. You know, they didn't have to do that for us. They did it for the other shift too. They did it for every team that was there. Unbelievable. To make you comfortable because we were helping them. The nicest people in the world. Fabulous. You know, for this to happen to these people. Then what happens to us, because we're the only team that has law enforcement agents on it, which was us, the law enforcement community that was in the building, and there was quite a bit, FBI, you know, just name a bunch of, know, law enforcement, federal agencies, they were in the building. It's a federal building, right? So these people would come to us with the pictures of their loved ones to our tent and hand you a picture and say, this is my wife. She was wearing a blue dress. Could you please find her? And now it became personal. The whole, everybody had a name. There was a face. And anybody that knows what, especially the guys in emergency, because we would go to horrific accidents and you would just do it. You didn't know who the people were. You didn't, you know, you did what you had to do. Bundle people with as much dignity as you could. Somebody hit by a train or in 10 pieces, you got to pick them up. It was no, you know, you didn't know who they were. But in Oklahoma, we did know who they were. And when they were found, most of the people were just sitting at their desk with a chunk of concrete on top of them, a coffee right there in front of them. You know, it was awful. It was really bad, really tough thing for me. It took me a year to not, until I went back. And I did go back a year later with McArdle and a couple guys for the year anniversary. And I haven't thought about it since, not in that way. I mean, I didn't sleep. You know, I dreamt about it every night for a year, every night. It was awful. So they had, there was two Marines lost there. And there was some digging going on in the front of the building. And somebody found the Marine, Captain Guzman. They found a leg. The blood stripe of his leg was uncovered. And once that happened, Mike Curtin, Sergeant Major, Marine Corps, former Beirut Force Recon Marine, the guy was been around the world.
He's in the Gulf War, too.
Yeah, yeah. So he gets wind of that, and he takes over. He goes to the bosses. He said, this is going to get done right, and it's going to get done by Marines. So he grabbed a team of Marines, Manny Hernandez, Juan Garcia. I can picture a guy. He was a paratrooper. He was a paramedic. I'm sorry, I forget his name. And the doctor was in on it too.
I think Chief Downey as well, because Chief Downey was a Marine.
Yeah, I can tell you he wasn't involved. Okay, he might have been up out of the hole. No. But so there was also, I end up being involved. I wasn't a Marine. My father was, but that had something to do with it. But there was a tool, a new pneumatic tool that I had been trained in for close, you know, quarters work. And, you know, Mike said, look, it goes against every grain that I have in the world because you weren't a Marine, but I'm taking you in the hole with me because I need that tool and you know how to use it. So we're going in. He said, plus your father was a Marine, so that's going to help you there too. So, you know, there was no joke in here. This was no joke. So they shut down the site over us, on top of us, for 15 hours. They gave us 15 hours to get this guy out. We had him out in 5 hours. Now, a lot went on in that hole, but we got him out all in one piece. And, you know, it was something that I'll never forget. You know, my father had passed away in 90 or 91. And being a former Marine, it was something to, like, reliving, you know, for him. As they brought out Captain Guzman, draped the Stokes, the site, it shut down totally. There wasn't a dry eye there, you know. It was amazing. Yeah. So that was, you know, pretty awesome to be part of. And then the next day, the Staff Sergeant Richardson, I believe his name was, he was recovered as well. So that was a high point, you know, to be part of it. It's part of Marine Corps lore. No Marines have ever been killed on United States soil in an act of war or in the like. So it was kind of a first.
You left in 2002. We talked a lot about the evolution of the FDNY tonight, right? The fire department you left in 2002 is so different than the fire department you returned to in 2014. I imagine that first day as fire commissioner, you walked into your office, you had to look around at the operation and say, holy crap, in a good way, of course. You guys have come a long way. Tell me about getting reacclimated to such a different, more well-rounded, really high-speed department, one that really adapted well to the 21st century.
I think it a tribute to the members in that interim period that, you know, took on these various roles, especially for chief officers and some of our civilian personnel managers, that, you know, took on themselves to move the department forward, whether it's with technology, whether it's with tactics, whether it was expanding training. All of these things really were improved. I think we realized with the McKinsey report after 9/11 that there were certain things we could have done better. And the members corrected many of them. Now, as commissioner, my role, you know, your role was more administrative and encouraging the chiefs from the chief of department on down to continue the work that they were doing of making the changes in the department that makes us more efficient. So the technical part of it, I left to them. I never tried to be fire chief as commissioner. I never responded to a fire and said, step aside. You know, I think I'll take command here. That's not the role of fire commissioner. Even fire commissioners like myself, Sal Cassano, who, you know, were chief of department at one time. Your role is different. You can observe, you can see who may be more efficient, who's the best for this role and who's the best for that role, but don't try to be the chief officer. You're the commissioner. It's a different role.
Back then, we didn't have what's known as anti-spalling. I'll make sure they put on. So the fragments, the bullet fragments shattered and then rode the bunker because the bunker moves. So that went into my face. So now I had bullet fragments in both my eyes and in my face. Tons. I think I sent you a photo of the x-ray.
I'm going to show it momentarily.
So on instinct, again, this is we talk about training because I'm no superhero. It's just muscle memory and reflex. And we're taught from day in, day out that you penetrate the location no matter what. My job is to stop the rounds. Did I know I got, you know, my bell rung? Absolutely not. I mean, for all I knew, you know, Mike Tyson just punched me, you know? Yeah. So it's funny because the term we used to joke about, it's like, you know, everybody has a plan to get punched in the face. Now I know what that feels like. So instinctively, my legs went forward. And I'm literally just pulling, you know, I'm shooting down range, thinking I'm shooting down range. Didn't realize that the bullet, and I still have my department issue, Glock 19, that has a scrape across it where a bullet shot out of my hand. So I'm still pulling the trigger, going forward. Another round comes, boom, hits the bunker dead on. So it's like somebody with a sledgehammer taking a running start and hitting you on the sledgehammer. Again, it's a narrow hallway, and I'm a big guy. For some reason, I guess his view is from the light coming outside, which is EMS vehicles, because where we found this guy was where EMS was staged, like the safe area. So all you saw was the occasional lights of the EMS, you know, vehicles. So third shot misses me completely. It's the wall, all nine shots. Fourth shot, again, hits the bunker. Boom, right on top. And I'm not knowing this because I'm blind. I'm just going on muscle memory. I'm just going forward. I'm literally on top of the guy, not knowing it. So he puts the shotgun to my leg and fires. And luckily, I had my gas mask strapped to my leg. On my left leg, and the gas mask has like a little Kevlar net that comes over when you put it on. It's like the same Scott pack that you see on the firemen use, and that stopped some of the rounds. So five penetrated my leg right to the bone, and I finally went down. And then I remember trying really hard not to lose consciousness, and I could hear this guy like in a panic just walking around, and I'm literally like reaching. I'm old school Bronx boy. I'm reaching for. I had a buck knife. I'm like, I'm gonna stab this guy, and you know, he gets near me, because I thought he was gonna finish me off. I didn't hear him load the gun though. That's why I was like, okay, this guy, you know, I could literally like smell this guy, even though like, you know, the tip of my nose was buzzed. And then he ran into the back, and then I had a little experience. My grandfather came to me in a vision and told me, "You want to live, want to die?" And I was like, "Yeah, I want to live." So I had gotten on the radio and I said, "Listen, guys, I'm down. Can someone get me?" Now, meanwhile, there's a gun battle going on now in the backyard. Now I'm hearing shots. And at the time, it was Santos Valentin's, God rest his soul. He was killed on 9/11. He recognized my voice. And he's like, "Hey, Big Joe is down. Big Joe is down." And apparently that's when, you know, a bunch of guys came in to rescue me and drag me out of there. What I didn't know behind me was that one of the rounds ricocheted off my bunker and hit Jimmy McGrath right between the eyes. Luckily, it didn't penetrate his skull, but it ripped him open. So, and then Billy Madigan saved him. And then Billy Madigan came back with, I think it was like Vic Holyfield and a bunch of other guys. And they came, they pulled me out from what, you know, from what I was told. I can't say what happened behind me because I wasn't there. I do know that I had a new guy behind me, and this is again when I talk about training, and it's not a popular thing. He ran. You know, he should have never been in emergency service. He had a Mini 14 because I remember ducking, thinking that the Mini 14 is going to go off, and it never did. And that's where Jimmy stepped up, and then Jimmy got tagged because the kid pushed past everybody. And the same thing with the Sergeant Griffin. He ran across the street, apparently. So, you know, this is the thing about this job is that this job is not for everybody. And they're not all perfect. But some people just are not made to be in this unit. And it pains me to say that, but it's the truth. And that's how we learn.
Yeah.
So, you know, then the whole rescue afterwards, they're not working on me. And I could feel the raindrops falling into my face because it's raining. And apparently somebody let a round almost hit me. It turned out that it was, again, Sergeant Griff let a round go and almost hit me. So they took his gun away. And it could put me into an R&P because I'm a big guy. And it was, what's his name? Big Asian guy. I love this guy. He's so bad with names. It'll come to me. Dave Kale. He's a real knowledgeable. He's a PA actually now in medicine. He put me in the back of an ambulance because a bunch of guys from crime scene detectives broke into an ambulance that was abandoned by EMS because they ran when the shots rang out. And mind you, there's a gun battle going on in the backyard.
Yeah, them I don't blame.
Yeah. And, I don't blame them at all. So they broke into the ambulance and put me in the ambulance, and they're driving me to Kings County Hospital, even though Coney Island Hospital is right across the street. But that's not a trauma center you want to go to. So I don't even know it's a trauma center. They're just like, hey, we're taking you to Kings County because that's where, you know, apparently the best surgeons are. And they were right. I'm not a Brooklyn guy, so I don't know anything about Brooklyn. And, you know, you try to find humor and everything. And K.O. is talking to me, you know, he's patching me up and stuff. And he's like, Joe, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. And he has like a weird accent. I don't know what it is, but it's just, he's a funny guy. I love this guy. And he's talking to me like, you're going to be fine. Meanwhile, he didn't realize he's leading into me, and his radio is right by my ear. So I'm hearing that. Start off the blood bank. Officers likely. I'm like, Dave, you're lying to me. They're telling me I'm going to die. It's okay. You know, and I'm reassuring him. Like, it's okay. He's like, no, don't listen to that. Whatever. It was just that whole ride. And at one point that they had to tell Highway to slow it down because that ambulance became airborne. They hit a pothole or something. And I could just feel that boom. And I'm bouncing the back of that bus. I mean, this guy's trying to, you know, they're doing their thing to get me to the ambulance. And to get me to the hospital. And, you know, interesting stuff goes on, you know, being on that side of the fence, because I've always been at the other side where, and it's one of the sucky parts of being a ESU cop is you see, you know, the whole routine when officers get shot, you know, don't get me wrong. We all go out of our way to make sure this cop makes it. You know, this is family here. And now I'm not the receiving end of that. I'm the one usually saving the day and the guys are saving me. And it was just like, I was actually, there was this calmness that came over me. Like, I wasn't worried about anything, I guess, because I was still in La La Land. You know, I just got my bell rung, so I was just like, it was just weird how calm I was. In fact, at the time, it was Chief Dunn, a great guy, by the way. He's talking, and they're trying to figure out if they could land a helicopter on my property, where I live, because they wanted to get next of kin, you know, get the wife. And they thought I was unconscious the whole time. I'm just laying there, just, you know, they're working on me, you know, doing whatever, taking my clothes off and checking me for holes. At one point, they, you know, check my butt. I'm like, hey, dude, that hole came with me. It's like the whole ER started laughing. I'm like, buy me a drink or something first, you know, before you do that. It's like, they're like, yeah, dude, oh, sorry, we have to check. I'm like, okay, whatever. And that's when Douglas goes, you're conscious? And I'm like, yeah, what's up? Because, again, I'm swollen and I'm, you know, I'm ugly to look at. And it's like, yeah, you could definitely land a helicopter in my backyard, but she ain't getting in that helicopter. I'm going to tell you that right now. It's not happening. Or you could go to, you know, there's a hospital nearby that has a helipad, too. And it's like, they ain't getting that in a helicopter. So don't even try that. So, but that was, yeah, that was pretty much it. And, of course, now that, you know, they put me out, they had to induce a coma to reduce the damage to my eyes. And I had, total out of the whole year, I had 23 surgeries.
Jeez.
To repair damage, including, you know, the fully detached retina, partially detached retina, a ton of little invasive stuff to remove, debride my entire face. I had bullets in my gum line. And you see, I had the hardest teeth ever because they were scraping lead off my teeth. I didn't lose a single tooth. I never had a cavity in my life either. So that's I guess it's a genetic thing. My father, my grandfather never lost a tooth. And, you know, they did do all different sections. I remember Ray Ruiz from Three Truck, great guy. Another, I say, I mean, good guys. He was one of the guys that used to drive me to my appointments. And he was like saying, no, they're filleting you. Because you sit there and watch the procedure. You know, and he's like, dude, they were like filleting you like a fish. It was like, it was interesting. And it turned out that my oral surgeon was the same oral surgeon for the New York Yankees. So every day, mind you, I wasn't a Yankee fan. I'm a Mets fan. And,
this podcast is over. I'm kidding.
It's funny because I grew up right next to Yankee Stadium. I used to love them in the 70s. After the first strike, I'm like, eh. Then I moved to Flushing. But anyway, that being said, every day is a new Yankee in there. So I ended up getting all this Yankee memorabilia, you know, and I gave it to my brother. He's a big diehard Yankee fan. Like Derek Jeter would come in, Joe Torre, whatever. And it was interesting, that whole thing. But the only horrible part about the shooting is that, yeah, you do go through an emotional toll, you post-traumatic stress. And then, you know, my biggest concern, and I asked, did anybody die behind me? And they said no. And they said I broke down because that was the most important thing to me, that nobody died. You know, I did what I had to do. And I still get emotional.
2004, I mean, that was like, that was the pinnacle of my career. You know, it's, it's something that I never thought was going to happen to me. It just kind of fell into my lap, you know, and, June 12th, 2004, Bobby Engel, Tree-Tree-O, dispatcher 330 in the Bronx, starts Rescue 3 out on a fire. I forget the exact address on Brooklyn Boulevard. But it sounds like there's going to be a roof rope rescue right from the get-go. You know, it sounds bad. And, you know, we start out over there, and Chief Corrigan from the 1-7 is acting deputy chief that night. And, you know, we pull up. Kevin Williams is the boss in Rescue 3, and I got the rope. And he says, Rescue 3, I need you on the roof. It looks like there's going to be a roof rope rescue up there. And, you know, we walk up a four-story adjacent, get up on the roof. I look over. I see 42 trucks setting up a roof rope evolution. I go over to the firefighter. I says, are you good? You know, that's the way we were in Rescue 3. We didn't step on anybody. A gentleman's rescue. We made sure that they knew what they were doing. Yes, I have it. I look over the shaft. You know, he's got it. I look over the shaft. And there's two different people hanging out the window, and there's a male hanging out of one apartment window, and it's a female, the evolution that they're starting on. And so the bulkhead's on fire. We have nowhere to tie off to up there. And Richie Bailey's my partner. I look over at Richie, and I said, hey, Richie, I said, you know, I'm going to be going over, and Kevin Williams is right there by me. And he says, where are we tying off to? I said, we're not tying off. I said, you know, you're going to take the turns on your hook, and I'm going to hook in, and we're going to go over. And basically it's an open shaft, if you will. I know it's kind of hard, you know, it's like this, you know, it's an open shaft. So there's a lady over here, and there's a guy here. And this evolution is going. You know, the guys in the loops, getting ready to go over, and, we're setting up our evolution, no substantial object. And, I won't name the company or the firefighter, but he steps out of the loops, where the lady was. And, Pat McKenna from, Rescue 3 steps in the loops. You know, somebody's got to go get this lady. And at the same time, there is a picture of both of us sitting on a parapet. You know, it's from a distance, shot from an adjacent building. And we both go over to the side of the parapet, and we pick off a male victim and a female victim. According to Kevin Williams, and he was the senior guy in SOC when he retired. Forget how many years he had. He said it's the first time a simultaneous roof rope rescue took place.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a side-by-side, you know. I mean, you know, you can look back, you know, with Patty Browns and Kevin Shays and, that was a tremendous, it was a high-profile job. It was a ballsy job, excuse me, you know, but you know, that's what it was, you know, but at the same time, you know, this one went off without a hitch, you know, like, you know, it's training outside the box. And you know, me knowing how to do this, it started back in 19 truck, you know, to go over without a substantial object. And we train on it as SOC firefighters, you know. But Steve Luisi, that's the captain of 44 truck, he was a covering boss, you know, bouncing around the Bronx as a lieutenant. He was a great guy. You know, he was always training this way, training that way. And he covered a lot in 19 truck. You know, he always wanted to, you know, he wasn't too much on building inspection at the time, you know, but, you know, he's like, let's train. And always training outside the box to know how to do this. And, you know, like he was there with me, not physically that day, but mentally he was there doing this, you know, with me to make sure that it went right. And amongst, you know, with the team I had on the roof, because it's, you know, they say dope on a rope, right? So Patty and Jeff are the dopes on a rope, you know, but at the same time, the brains that are, you know, setting up the evolution and lowering the guys that are there, they got to know how to make it work. But anyway, you know, I get a medal for this on Medal Day, and I'll just speed forward on that real quick. It's just because Steve Luis, he's there at Gaelic Park, and, you know, I just, you know, I went up to him, I hugged him, and, you know, we're just talking, and I'm like, yeah, you were there with me, brother. You know, you taught me this, you know, and that was a big thing. It was a big sense of accomplishment, you know, like, you know, I came to Rescue 3 October 5th of 01, and I think that we really proved ourselves that day, you know, that we could, as a unit, we could operate. It's not just me and Patty. It's a unit operating, and we made it work, you know, and I think that was, and, it, you know, that year in 2004, Danny Foley made a confined space rescue. It was, I know, a guy was caught in some type of fuel tank. He was in the fuel tank, and he was overcome by fumes, and Danny made a brave rescue. You know, he went in on air, you know, with the dart cart that we had, you know, like breathing air, you know, cause you can't wear an SCBA in there. You got to have like a confined space air. And, anyway, he goes in and he makes a rescue. So Rescue 3 that year, made three high profile rescues in 2004, you know, and, I don't know, you think somebody from downtown or the mayor's office would have seen it, you know, and say, hey, you know what? This is a good thing, you know, like what these guys are doing, you know. I mean, it's showing that the department is moving on, you know, and with all that experience that we lost, and we'll never gain that experience back again, but they are operating, you know, to a high standard, if you will, you know.
98, 99, I went there.
Yeah.
So then I go to the range one day, and old partner from, you know, guy from my team from street crime is a sergeant down at the range. And he says, listen, I'm getting picked up by this unit in OCCB to do tactical training. Are you interested? And at the time, Chief Morange, who was my captain in street crime, was the chief of OCCB. So he's like, I want to bring some guys back. I want to change these tactics. You know, guys are, you know, getting hurt out there. And Jim Hart, who was doing this tactical training thing up at the range, really had a really good method of doing, you know, warrants and searches. And it was a good concept. And he worked with me. He said, so listen, he said, you want to come on board with this? I said, absolutely. So I'm at the range in my crappy T-shirt, jeans. He said, all right, they're doing interviews today at 1PP. Head over there right now. I said, this is all I got. He goes, don't worry, I'll call ahead. I'll tell him that's all you got. So I went over there, and who was the XO of OCCB at the time was Chief Matarazzo. So I saw him there, and there's all these guys sitting outside his office in suits waiting to go in. And they called me in first. I went in, and I walked out, and I pretty much had my spot from there. So I got transferred over to the OCCB Training Bureau. It was called TIRS at the time, Training Investigative Review Section. So they were doing the thing. But we were going to start a whole new search warrant thing because they were building the new tack house up in the Bronx. So we were going to be assigned to the range, work out of the tack house, and we're doing all the tactical training now. So we're going to do search warrant training, vehicle takedowns, undercover extractions. Those are some of the things we implemented. And we really changed the way OCCB did their warrants. From 2001, when I got there, actually 2000, the end of 2000 to 2005 when I retired, not a single OCCB cop was injured on a search warrant from any kind of gunfire situation. They were taking guns like, you know, crazy and drugs, but there were no shooting incidents the whole time that we were running this unit, and for years after. So what we were doing was working.
It was a real surprise to me because, you know, I was hoping Rudy would call me and tell me that he wanted me to be police commissioner, because I knew Rudy a very long time. I knew him when he was an assistant U.S. attorney. And then when I became chief of operations of the Marshal Service, he was the associate attorney general at the Department of Justice. And basically, I reported to him. So we got to know each other very well, both professionally, and we became very good friends. Right. And so when he called me and said, I want you to be fire commissioner, I honestly didn't know what to say. And then finally I said, Rudy, I don't know anything about fire. I said, how the heck am I going to be fire commissioner? And he said, you know how to lead, you know how to manage. He says, they need somebody to be their advocate. They need somebody to help them progress as a department. And he says, I think you can do it. And then he kind of, as an aside, said, you never know how long a police commission is going to last. And he said, I'm not promising you anything, but if that job comes open, we can talk.
There you go. And you would talk 2 years later.
Quite honestly, that was the magic words for me. Because there's nothing I would have rather been than the New York City Police Commission.
She looks at you so coolly, and her eyes shine.
you take her to find what's waiting inside. The year of the cat.
But for now you're gonna stay in the year of the cat.